welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast Season 3, culminating with the Layer 8 Conference on Saturday, October 8th in Providence, Rhode Island. This season, we'll have conversations with social engineers and OSINT investigators who will tell their stories. We hope you enjoy them. Welcome to another episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We have a very special guest for you today. Welcome, Shannon.
Hi.
For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Yes. I run a company called Lockdown Your Life. So you probably know me if you follow Twitter at all, my Lockdown Your Life handle. And I'm the same across all platforms to make it nice and simple for everybody. I do appreciate that you called me special. I don't know whether to take that as a compliment or an insult, but I do work in a special niche where I deal with mostly harassment and stalking cases, specifically cyber stalking and cyber harassment. But I also work in the space of domestic violence, domestic awareness, and I do a lot of volunteer work with organizations that do the same. Most of my background is involved in government and DOD, and you know, it's nothing fancy, it's DOD contracting. So I got into security work in the government, and then when I left about 8-9 years ago now. I can't believe it's been almost a decade, but I didn't know anything about OSINT, so I was not I'm self-taught. Everything I know comes from research on my own, because like when you're in government, you have specialists who do OSINT and who do human SIG and all the INTs, so you have people, analysts, you know, people that specialize in different areas. And I was not part of an OSINT team. So all of the learning that's happened came when I came out. And it was as a result of, there was a family friend who got involved with this really nasty romance scam. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars of fraud. So that kind of, it made it really personal. So like, I already had this background in security, and it kind of brought into the forefront, like how common it is for really smart people to get scammed or harassed, or if you have any sort of following on the internet, if you have 5 followers and you're woman identifying, you're going to have harassment. So it just became this very commonplace thing that happens to men too. It happens to non-binary. It happens to a lot of marginalized populations that harassment and stalking occurs. And people think that, oh, it will never happen to me. But you know, you get your first troll and then it just builds from there. So there's a lot of personal examples I can use, but that one particular one of the family friend was kind of what brought me into this world. And I was like, okay, so I clearly have a background in it. I have an understanding of security and the layers of it, of human behavior and analysis. That's where my specialty is. So I'm not super technical, but I do know people and I understand patterns, and that's what I'm trained in. So that's kind of the bio of how I got my company. And that's kind of, people are like, well, why Lockdown Your Life? Because every area of your life is online now. Everything is digital. You have your online footprint. You have all of these things that lead you to be online, whether you're comfortable with it or not, your information is going to be out there. So it's better to go in prepared for something than to be surprised by something. So that's kind of my background, my bio, and how I got into it. And I'll leave it there.
As you mentioned, your website is Lockdown Your Life, where you have a whole bunch of services on there, including ways to lock down your life, and focuses on privacy. I think one of the first questions I had for you is privacy even possible nowadays? And we can also separate online to out in the real world. Is it possible to have privacy?
I think that's a really hard question to answer. It's a good one to ask, but you have to think about it in layers. Like you have layer 8, we have layers to privacy. And it depends on how you think about privacy, whether you think of it from a legal perspective or you think of it from a personal perspective. We all have something that we don't want out in the world, that we don't want other people to know about us. Maybe it's a personal decision or our political leanings or a medical decision, or it could be a relationship. It could be all of these things. These are all matters of your own privacy and what you feel people should know about you or what they should not know about you. So it's a nuanced thing. When I say privacy, it's such a broad topic and we have so many things that get in the way of it, both from a technological perspective and from a personal viewpoint perspective. So I don't want to just say blanket privacy. When I talk to a client or when I have somebody come to me asking about a specific issue, I say every client and every case is unique, because what privacy means to one person is different than what it means to another. So when we speak of privacy, when we speak of the issue of privacy, I want to be very clear that for each person, it's a little bit different. And my answer is going to be a little bit different. And that's not to say I don't want to respond to the question and answer it. It's just, it depends. And that's an answer we all hate in security. We hate it in technology, but that's the way it is because everyone is different. I will say, yes, you can have some degree of privacy. Now, you might not take it off the grid type privacy like some people do, but for safety and security reasons, whatever your situation, for example, if you're a domestic violence survivor, your privacy and where you live, your address, your home, your location, if your ex happens to know about that, or if your family member leaks that information, it could be life or death for you. So I think that, yes, there can be privacy, and I do believe it is a human right. However, that is now being tested. So we will see what happens. And I kind of respond to things as they come to me, but we're all doing the best we can right now.
And you do also offer personal consultancies to help people to lock down their life and to get into privacy. And I understand that one size doesn't fit all, but would you have even just one generic, wide-reaching piece of advice for listeners on something that they could think about with their own personal online privacy, maybe something that they haven't thought about before that you can just kind of throw out there and say, think about this with regard to your own privacy and make a decision about that for yourself?
The first thing I always ask my clients is, what is the worst thing about you that I'm going to find? Tell me the worst thing that happened to you. And that takes an incredible amount of trust in my first conversation with somebody to ask them, I know this is really personal. I'm sorry, this sounds insensitive, but I need you to tell me what I'm going to find. Because I will find it. Someone will find it. It will be me, or it will be someone else looking out for you, or it will be a stalker, a harasser, or your ex, or whoever is after you. If they're going to look somewhere, where are they going to find it, and what will it be? And then I'm not surprised. If I already know the thing that you're worried about, then we can put a plan in place to get ahead of it. So I guess my general advice, if you're speaking to the average end user, which not necessarily our audience is not always security and technical people. There's a lot of people that don't know the basics of privacy. Understand what's out there about you. Like, do a Google search on your name, do an internet search on yourself, and find out what is out there that could harm me. What is out there that could hurt my family, myself? You know, all your family connections lead to you. So from a social engineering perspective, or if reverse engineering this in terms of privacy, knowing is half the battle, because then we can know what we can deal with, what we can take away, what you want to leave out there, what we could introduce into the mainstream, what we could remove from search results, how we can protect your privacy, your reputation, your brand, your business, whatever it is that they're after. They're going to go after everything if they're after you, but it's understanding what's out there so that you can be prepared. Because like, the worst thing that happens in a crisis is that the thing comes out and you can't control the narrative. So that's part of crisis management. And that's a large part of what I do is crisis management, because I'm managing you at your highest emotional state when you're at the worst moment of your life, where the thing that you never thought would happen to you happens. And it could be any number of things. It could be the stalking, harassment, abuse, but it could also be a family member, a friend. It could be a boyfriend, an ex, a girlfriend. It can be a lot of things. I've seen every single shade of rainbow and scenario. So it doesn't happen in isolation. And so knowing who you are and what people know about you and what you don't want them to know, that's part of it too. So when somebody says to me, I don't care about my privacy, I'm thinking you should, because yeah, you're getting targeted ads from a tech company, but that means that there's only like few points of anonymization between you and the information about you, the worst thing about you. And I'm like, if you have a particular kink or fetish or a particular relationship you don't want people to know about, and like, I do not kink shame. I do not judge about fetish. I don't care. It does not matter to me what you do in the privacy of your own home, as long as you're not harming yourself or others. So if you approach it from that perspective and you think about all the things that make you you and make you unique, what are those things that could harm or hurt or help you? So like kind of all of those things in a rainbow, if that makes sense.
So you've seen people find lots of different things about themselves. And have you seen instances where you tell somebody to investigate themselves and they are surprised with what they find?
Yes. Here's a good example. Let's say you have a breakup with somebody. Everyone's had an ex-boyfriend, ex-girlfriend, ex-significant other. And that person, for whatever reason, decides to be an asshole. And that happens a lot. Like, the breakup was bad. They didn't agree with it. They didn't want to break up for whatever reason. And they decide, hey, I'm just going to like write a blog post, or I'm going to dig up something that I did back in, you know, 1995, like our first website. I'm going to find photos of you, something embarrassing. It might not be anything like super bad, but like, it's bad enough that maybe your employer or your current partner might question you about it. So like, if you're finding something that's incriminating that you didn't expect to see, like the internet is forever. We can find almost anything. It's really hard to get rid of something that old. That's what the Wayback Machine is for. Like that's one of the most used open source tools in the world. It's fantastic, but it's also really awful because you can see how bad your haircut was in 1996. I'm speaking for myself. So if somebody really wants to go after us, like, they're going to be looking at our teenage years. Like when some of us did not have to put our pictures on the internet until we were in our 20s, maybe like when the internet was like HTML and GeoCities. I'm really dating myself now, but you get my point. So like, I'm trying to go for the lighter side of what you could find. You know, obviously if you have criminal cases or if you have domestic violence accounts against you, that's public record. It's, you can get those public records from the courts. So those won't surprise you if that happened to you. But again, if you're going under an alias or an assumed name, like if somebody knows what to look for, or you have a maiden name, you could find something under somebody's maiden name that they didn't want you to know. So yes, it just depends on what's been introduced to the internet environment.
And while we might not be able to take down a blog post that an ex wrote about us, do you have advice or any way that people can scrub their own privacy? Maybe they did put up a picture of an embarrassing photo from when they were 17 years old.
We all have those too. We all have those really bad photos of ourselves. Like you were underage at a party and you shouldn't have been, but we all did it. Yeah. So the cool thing that's happened recently is Google has now instituted a new policy that they can have if you are a victim of harassment, stalking, or there is some information out about you that you don't want on their search results, you can have it removed. You can request to have it removed from Google search. And as you know, Google is the largest search engine in the world, probably one of the biggest proliferators of information about you. And yes, you still have to give your ID to them to get your information removed. But from a safety and privacy standpoint, this is big because when you remove it from Google, all of the trickle down effect of the internet, you know, it shows up in other minor search engines. It shows up in data aggregation sites. So those sites that collect all your personal and sell your personal data, like Facebook sells all your personal data to everyone. So like all that information they've now collected about you, once you've removed it from Google, once you've removed information about yourself, that's going to have a trickle down effect. Do I know what that will look like yet? No, but this is a big deal for, you know, people who are concerned about privacy or who are concerned about being doxxed. Cause I know that happens. Like there's been this huge movement. I don't know if you're on TikTok or anything, but like people outing each other, like people with large platforms using it to build what they call clout on the internet. I'm not up on all the terms, but like the kids, they call it clout. So you're basically building this big platform and then you're going after people who disagree with you or you're going after people who cause harm. But again, even if it's somebody's like work that they put on LinkedIn or their name or their partner that's on Facebook, these people hunt them down and put out their information. Now, I'm very much against doxing. I do it on principle because I don't think it helps. I think if you deprive that person of social capital rather than giving air to their name, rather than, yes, contact their family members, contact their place of employment. I'm not opposed to that. But once you start down that rabbit hole, if you are wrong, if you got the wrong person, which does happen because data aggregation sites often have people have a very common name. So like there's hundreds of us. So they could find somebody with a similar background of a similar age with a similar name in a similar state and think it's you and out you to your employer. And it's not even you. So it's a very dangerous, like double-edged sword of like, yes, you want to out your abuser. Yes, you want to out this information, but you can also affect future investigations. You can affect the work I'm already doing or someone like me. You can affect your own reputation because you might get it wrong and you're still going to get harassed and stalked for it. So if you are working with an investigator, please do not stalk your stalker. You could have crimes against you now. Like you could have harassment charges filed against you for going after the very person that you wanted to out. So you just have to be very, very careful. That I'm not saying don't do it. I don't personally. I just think you need to be really, really careful about any personally identifiable information. We're talking social security numbers. We're talking addresses. We're talking phone numbers that are not readily available. Like you actually have to buy the information from a data aggregator. Please don't do that. Don't do that to people, even if they're horrible. It's just, that's my stance. I know people will disagree with me and I understand that, but I also understand how devastating it is to a sexual abuse or harasser or domestic violence survivor to have their information on the internet, to have their abuser out them. And I understand you want to out your abuser, but it could affect your custody of your kids. It could affect your investigation. It could affect your own case. So you have to be really careful. And it's very unfair. And I understand that.
And if somebody is being harassed online, what advice do you give them on how to handle that if they should not go investigate who is harassing them or out them? If somebody is starting to be harassed online, what advice do you have for them?
Giving generic advice is always very dangerous, in my opinion, but I would always say know what kind of harassment you're dealing with. There's different levels of predatory behavior. There's different levels of predator. And, you know, there's the ones who like the trolls, the low-level trolls who will like, you know, keep trolling you, you block them, they'll create 10,000 more accounts and still keep going after you. If they escalate when you tell them to stop, that's more of an issue for me, because that tells me that the attention that you give them will drive them to do more. But if you do nothing, they'll still do that too. So you just really want to assess, is this a targeted harassment campaign? Is it a bot campaign? It's like there are a bunch of like dozens of accounts swarming your account. I would say if it's happening, you know, go private for a little while, go offline just to get yourself together, to get your support network together, to talk to people about what's happening to you. Because the biggest problem you have is the emotional damage. And I know we're all thinking of that sound from TikTok, emotional damage. But it's very damaging to your psyche. It's very hard when you're being targeted. And sometimes you know who's doing it and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you can prove it and sometimes you can't. Reporting and blocking them is sometimes the best and easiest thing you can do, but they'll keep coming. Again, I have it too. I have stalkers, I have harassers, I have people that come after me. And it's mental. A lot of it is mentally being prepared and just having a good support system in place. Understanding your enemy, if you will, understanding what you're dealing with, and you know, going as private as you feel necessary, whether it's going offline or going private on your accounts or removing some information about yourself from the internet, or you know, if you need to get a PO box instead of your home address, just to obfuscate some of your information a little bit more, doing data opt-out on some of the aggregation sites. There's a Intel Techniques has a great free workbook from Michael Bazell. And all the sites are listed. I also have it replicated on my site as well. And I update it regularly, probably every 2 weeks, I find more databases. But again, this new thing with Google being able to remove your information from the search results may have a huge impact on those data aggregation sites being shut down, just because they won't have anything to sell, because they won't have your information. I don't know that for sure. I'm speculating here. This is all beans. I don't know. So these are just basic small things. Like, and I'm not going to say they're not going to take time. They do. But it's half the battle is knowing it. And part of that is like mentally being prepared and taking care of your well-being, taking care of your mental health, talking to someone about it, making sure if you need therapy, getting the help you need, and not letting it consume you, because it will, and you become really paranoid. I've done it myself. Like, it's really hard. It's a very fine balance. And when it's a targeted harassment campaign over years, when the person just won't stop, there is so very little we can do. And it's so frustrating, because as you know, harassment and stalking laws vary by location, and none of them are created equal. And all the onus is on the victim to document, screenshot, put it in a timeline. That's the thing I always suggest at first, is like, get a record of everything that you see. Other people that see it, you will have people sending you stuff. I have people send me stuff all the time. The reason I have a list of people I know in InfoSec specifically who are harassment and stalkers, who are abusers, the reason I have that list is because people tell me, because you have to build trust and you have to understand that like me outing all those people isn't going to do anything but depriving them of their social capital, depriving them of their targets, depriving them of their oxygen, that stops it. So at some point they'll be outed. I'm not responsible for all of that. And I do my best to do it with nuance and with kindness and with grace, but I know they don't deserve it. I know people who do that and harass and stalk other people and abuse them. They don't deserve that at all, but that's the way the system is built. And if I want justice for my victims, I have to protect them at all costs.
And at what point does it cross over into where somebody should contact law enforcement?
It's again, a personal decision, because, you know, local law enforcement, a lot of them don't have the technical capability to assist with a cyber investigation. But if it is an online harassment and stalking campaign, you can report it to the FBI, because it's a federal crime, because it crosses state lines. So FBI handles anything that's, and they have the equipment and the capability to do it if it's a long-term campaign. But you should report it. Do report it, because there's a record. This is the most important thing, is that there's a record of what happened to you. And I know this sounds really bad, but like, if it escalates, if there's a physical contact in the real world offline from this person who's harassing and stalking you, you have a record that you reported it to the police. So even if they're like, oh, we can't prove anything, we don't have anything, you give them a hard copy of your documentation. You put everything in a timeline, you document it all, you save hard copies of it. and you get a copy of the police report and you hold on to that too. And you report every time it happens to you and you give them everything. And you can't, they can't say we didn't know. So if something happens to you, there is a record. And I know that's horrible to say, if there's violence or threats against you, you have to report it to the police, especially any type of threat. That's one of my screening questions is, have you been threatened? And then we're like, well, what does that mean? Have they threatened to kill you? Have they threatened to come to your house? Have they threatened to unalive you? What have they threatened to do to you? Report it to the police. That is very, very serious. Report it to the FBI as well. So I say I'm always more pro reporting than not reporting, even when they don't believe you. I won't leave the police station until they file a report. I will annoy you until you do what I want, because who's going to advocate for you but you? No one else is going to do it for you, unfortunately. That is the sick part. The other thing I always suggest is, if you are going to report it, or if you're pretty sure who it is, consult with a lawyer. You can usually get a free hour, pay an hourly fee for a consult, just so you know the laws in your area, what you're dealing with, what kind of legal ramifications and or methods you have, so that, because I'm not a lawyer, I can't give you legal guidance, but I want you to have as many tools at your disposal as possible to address your issues, whether it's, you know, non-consensual pornography, revenge porn, or harassment or stalking or whatever the case may be.
And is this documentation also where sometimes the idea of calendars comes into play? Because I think we saw during some Senate hearings, even calendars come in. Is storing information on a calendar or emailing documentation to yourself something that you can
recommend? I mean, it's an option and I do it. We have to do what's convenient. I use the program called Hunchly to track all of my documentation. They have a free version of it for victims of domestic violence, harassment, or abuse or stalking. They have a free app available for download where you can save all your screenshots and organize them by date and by content. And so it's a very easy to use app. They have it, like, it's free. So it's a great tool and I recommend it to anybody, because if for some reason, and courts require a massive amount of documentation, especially if you're dealing with a family court, a custody case, for example, and you were married to your abuser, you are going to have so many notebooks full of information and they're going to expect you to have it all organized so that you know what you're doing just to have custody of your kids. So I always recommend to document in that form. And it's a really great, just, I use it as a case management tool, but it's also really great for victims because it helps them feel in control. It gives them a tool at their fingertips where they're like, I'm doing something for myself. I'm taking care of myself. I'm taking care of my kids. I feel a little bit safer because I've got what I need in my hands and I can send it to police. You can just, it organizes it all and then you send it over to them. So that's what I recommend.
I want to circle back to something that you said, I think probably during your introduction, that is probably, I think this is something that all women know and many men don't know. And you mentioned that if you have a female presenting persona online, you are going to get harassed. Yes. And I think that is one of those things that, like I said, all women know, many men don't know. Is that something you can talk a little bit more about, just to kind of drive that home that that does exist?
Yes. As a woman presenting, as somebody who identifies as a woman, there's also non-binary people who are women presenting, any marginalized community as well, especially women. If you identify with any of those communities, LGBTQIA, Black, Brown, Hispanic, whatever, you are much more likely to get harassed. And I do a free webinar once a month talking about the statistics, and it's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting what marginalized groups deal with. If you are a cishet white male, your chances of getting harassed are pretty low. And I'm not speaking about that, and I'm not trying to be negative about it, but, like, yes, all men. You think that it won't happen to you. It could, but we women know, we non-binaries know, we all know what it's like, because we wake up in the morning, we say nothing controversial. We say, good morning, I had coffee. And you will have somebody respond to you, I hate coffee. I can't believe you would make coffee. They will argue with you just to argue with you. They will go after you just to go after you. I posted a screenshot yesterday of something that somebody left in my replies about a photo that I posted when somebody called me Butch. And then this person came after me and, like, said some things I won't repeat on your podcast because I don't know how suitable for work you are. But, like, let's just say it was really gross. And I screenshot, I said, hey, you know, report this account. This person has gone after not just me, but other people. But that's just a day in the life. That's just an example of, I have an auto mute feature on my account. I can't see responses from you unless I follow you. So I go through them, like, once a week just to see what's there. And it's filthy. It's gross. And it's, And it's every day. So you literally have to have like skin like a rhino. You have to develop such a thick skin that you're not impacted by what people say about you, because at the end of the day, it's not going to stop it. Like, I could just delete my account tomorrow and I would still get some dude on the street telling me to smile. So the past like 2.5 years wearing a mask have been delightful. I haven't had one man say smile to me. I give off leave me alone energy and people still bother me. I'm like, really? It's an everyday thing. We make these calculations about being online and what we say and what we do and how we think about it and what does this mean? And it's never conscious unless we have to make it so. Like, I run, for example. So if I go outside and I'm going to go for a run, I have to calculate my safety the entire way along that route. I have to tell my partner where I'm going. I have to tell them how long I'll be gone, when I'll be back, what route I'm taking, my phone location. I carry a weapon with me at all times. I calculate what I wear. Is it gonna, like, because you know somebody's gonna ask me if I get assaulted, what were you wearing? Oh, I'm sorry, officer. I was wearing, you know, running shorts and a top. Like, it doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter, but it does to people. So I tend to go against everything like that. And I'm just me. But for a lot of people who get harassed regularly or have targeted harassment or swarms of harassment, it is unending and it is exhausting. So I don't know how to drive it home more than, if you've been in any of these communities, if you are a woman, or if you are non-binary, or if you are anything different than a cishet white male, you have been harassed. It's just the way it is.
Thanks for doing that. Yeah, that's, I think that's exactly what I was looking for, because you're right. As a cis white male, I don't get harassed for who I am. And every time that I see women on Twitter say, do guys have to deal with this? And I just think, no, we generally don't. And it's pathetic, basically. So thanks for adding that. Also, another thing that I saw in your Twitter timeline that might be a little bit timely is you added a thread about the basics on attending a protest.
Oh,
can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So back during the George Floyd protests, Black Lives Matter stuff, which I think should still be going on, because, you know, it's a whole thing. Anytime you go to a protest, if you notice there was people saying that Antifa was causing the protests, or that you have right and left wing arguing about who did what, but, you know, there was violence. There was a lot of violence in for George Floyd. And for good reason. People were out there doing what they felt was right. They were protesting against the death of a man who had a knee on his neck. So I cannot go out and protest because of other reasons, because of health reasons and safety reasons, but I can go support those who do. And the way that I can do that is by providing guidance on how to not get your photo taken by police, how to protect your privacy a little bit more, what kind of phones to take with you, if any, how you document police brutality, how you document what's happening on the ground. You know, we had the January 6th riots, and that was all documented. We had all the protests that were documented, but we also had police going after the protesters simply for showing up and being able to use their First Amendment rights, free speech, and the right to protest. That is a constitutional right for us. So the fact that people feel unsafe doing so, or they're going out and they're not thinking about what could possibly happen to me, I could get arrested. Like, you know, we had all those bail funds, like people were crowdfunding getting people out of jail after the Black Lives Matter protests, because police were just arresting people and not asking questions. So I just put together a thread of, you know, here are your rights. Don't let them take your phone, take all your biometric data off of it. Use a PIN code. Don't give it over to them for any reason. Set it up for remote wipe if you're taking your standard phone. Preferably use a burner phone. Don't organize over text messages or DMs. Do it over an encrypted messaging app. Have all your messages disappear. Have a plan if you do get arrested. Know your legal aid numbers. Protect your face from cameras, because there's a lot of CCTV cameras, especially in DC. So if you're coming to any major city, you're going to be on camera. So just think about what you're wearing into the protest, do a profile change out of the protest, change what you're wearing, take an extra sweatshirt or hoodie or, something of a different color so that it's harder for them to find you. And if they do arrest you, ask if you're being arrested or detained. And if the answer to that is not yes to one of those, then you don't have to say anything. And if they say, yes, you're being detained, or yes, you're being arrested, you say, I want a lawyer and nothing else. You do not talk to police for any reason. Never. Do not trust them for any reason. They might be the nicest person in the world. They might be a good police officer. I don't know, and you don't either. So it's really about knowing your rights and knowing what is and isn't allowed. And yes, they can detain you. They can try to question you. Doesn't mean you have to say anything, because like the worst thing that happens is you ask for a lawyer and you keep talking. Technically, they can't use any of that against you, but they can lie to you, and they will. So I guess for me, it's always about knowing what's allowable for you and how far they're willing to go. Now, I think under the current administration, we've gone back to a place where there's a little bit more respect for the protesters, but not always. You still have those systems of built-in, you know, rage against the protesters. So I don't think that a lack of education should be a reason not to go to a protest, but I think you should have the tools you need to be safe.
I think that's really helpful. And along those same lines is secure communications. You also have a big thread in your Twitter account about secure communications, which is probably something that you should also use during a protest, but you also gave situations like if you've been stalked or harassed, or if you feel like a spouse or partner spying on you, if you're a journalist or activist, you're concerned about your privacy. What are just some general ways, without giving away the whole thread, I guess?
It's a long thread and it needs to be updated. I think the last time I wrote it was like 2020, and there's been some changes, like some, but not major. I think when you're thinking about secure comms, like some people think that text messages are secure. An end user might not know that people can read your text messages. They can be intercepted. Now, iMessage is encrypted. So there is that. If you're an iMessage user from user to user, I think those are encrypted. I don't have an iPhone. I'm 100% on what that looks like anymore. But I would still recommend you use a different messaging app if you're going to talk to people and set up disappearing messages, especially if the information that you're exchanging is really personal. Or again, if you're organizing to go to a protest, y'all know where you're going to meet. Y'all know what time you're going to meet. So just do that and then delete the messages. But you have to make sure they're disappearing on both ends. Or if the cops get your phone on the other end, they're going to know who was in the message thread or in the group chat. So don't organize on DMs and Twitter. Don't do that, because Twitter has all of it. And if they get a subpoena, they have to turn over those records. So I usually suggest Signal. I know every environment is different. Every country is different. I understand that this is not a blanket coverage for everything, but you can organize through Signal. You can use that. It's an encrypted messaging app and it's fairly well relied upon by groups. Also Wire is my second recommendation, because you don't have to use a phone number. You can just set up a fake email account and use it that way, and just set up a user account and then just delete it off your phone when you're done if you don't want to use it anymore. I used to recommend Wickr, but they were bought by Amazon and I have questions. So I'm not super 100% about that. Now, mind you, it was built by the military. So Wickr, in terms of if we want to talk about military grade security, which I know in the technical InfoSec world, everybody's like, I hate that word. It's terrible. I hate it. But I don't recommend Wickr as much, but it is a possibility. And then Threema was the other one that I thought of. I don't use it, but you have options. Most of those have disappearing messages available. You can set up group chats. You can delete everything off of your phone, remote wipe it, whatever. But the reason we use that is because any communication between you is encrypted. Now, is it unbreakable? No, nothing is. So just be mindful of what you say and be mindful of what you put out there and just assume that somebody is going to find it.
At the beginning, you said you got started in this because somebody that you were familiar with was involved with a romance scam and you wanted to help them get out of that. Is that a story you're willing to talk about?
Getting out of it, well, they paid a lot of money. Let's put it that way. So a family member of mine, this was, I want to say 5-6 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. They contacted me because they had a new boyfriend. And this person, I think I have a whole thread about it, like how to spot a romance scam. I did a whole thread on it. But the background of the story is like my family member contacted me because they had a new boyfriend and they had never met this person. They talked to them on the phone. It was very much the love bombing, giving all these compliments. And all of a sudden they were like in love and they'd only been speaking for a couple of weeks. And like this person was just laying it on thick. And I was just, I was asking questions about, okay, so how did you meet? Oh, we met online. And I was like, where did you meet? Like, was it on a messaging app? Were you on Facebook? Like, I think they've reached out on Facebook, if I remember correctly. Anyway, so they set up a fake profile and I was like, okay, so what's their name? And the name they were going by was like super weird. And I was like, this seems a little strange. Okay, let me just do a little bit of digging. And I just, you know, I was like, you came to me, so let me just like dig a little bit. You know my background. So I like, I did a quick internet search. I was like, I couldn't find anything on this person. I was like, this, I'm pretty sure this is a scam. I, you know, this just doesn't quite feel right. This was a person that was claiming to be an oil worker in Malaysia. So that's not unheard of. There are lots and lots of Americans who work overseas in Saudi Arabia, in Malaysia, in South Korea. Like there is plenty of places you can work as an American, as in, as a, you know, an oil worker or in the oil industry. That wasn't what got me. What got me was, you know, they talked on the phone, but like they had never seen each other on camera. There had been no like video conferencing. They're like, well, do you want to talk to them? They're willing to talk to you. Now, keep in mind, I worked for the government at this point. And I was like, you're giving out personal information about your child that is a, you know, foreign service officer with the State Department. And I'm like, you're giving out this information to somebody you've never met and you have not seen in person, but like you've arranged plane tickets. And then every time the plane tickets were arranged, they canceled on you at the last minute. I was like, do you not see the pattern here? And I'm like, I'm trying not to be mean about it. I'm like trying to say it in a loving, kind way of, I just want you to be aware that these things are what a scam looks like. This is what fraud looks like. Didn't believe me, kept going with it, kept sending money to them, you know, because all of a sudden this individual couldn't access their bank account. This individual couldn't, their credit card was stolen. The last story I heard was that this person had been kidnapped. So I was like, at that point, it gets worse. Oh, you think that's not the worst part? So the worst part is this person, my family member, called the U.S. Embassy in Kuala Lumpur to see if they could find this individual, this American who had been kidnapped in Malaysia, who was an oil worker. And they're like, yeah, ma'am, we have no record of this. You may want to contact the FBI. This sounds like a scam. So of course, when somebody is so far into the con and they're so convinced that they're right, no matter what you say, they aren't going to listen to you. And I could just see you agonizing over there going, oh God, it gets worse. Like, because we're talking $100,000+ sent to Malaysia. And now I'm going to remind you that most scam artists, most romance scam artists don't get that much out of one person. They get it, you know, they might get 20,000 if they're lucky. They might get a couple grand if they're lucky. Most of them have this long con going on with multiple women at the same time. They're looking for vulnerable women. They're looking for divorced men and women, widows, widowers, people who've been on Tinder a long time, people who have small children. You know, they know what to look for. They profile you. They see that you're talking about your divorce on Facebook or on Twitter or on Tinder, wherever they're finding you, and they're profiling you. They do the psychological profiling, just like I do when I'm evaluating somebody or looking at a target. I'm like, what are their motivations? What would make them, what's the most appealing thing I could tell them? How can I convince them that I'm real? So these are all things that happen to you in the state. And like when you're in that honeymoon phase of love, it feels so genuine and you just want to be loved. And so it happens to really smart people. This woman has a master's degree. She's not unintelligent. She's bright. She's capable. And it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating to watch this happen. And afterwards, it was like, they're so full of shame about it. They won't tell anybody what happened to them. And I'm like, you could be a lesson to somebody else. You could stop this person from doing it to someone else. And, you know, we eventually reported it to the FBI. I don't know what came of it, if anything, but like, they're basically like, yeah, your money's gone. Once you send it, there's nothing you can do. This woman is out $100,000. That is not like that to anyone. That's a huge sum of money. And I just, I don't know how to come to terms with that still. I'm just like, I still don't know what to say about it because it was so insane. So yeah, that's some of the context.
Yeah, one of the reasons that I wanted to hear a little bit more about that is because there's a TV show that I like to watch called Trafficked with Mariana Van Zeller. And mm-hmm. She recently talked about these romance scams and she actually went to the locations where the scammers are and showed exactly how they work. So You're right, $100,000 is a lot of money and it's great for that story to get out there to help others. But even on the show, there were people that lost 10 times that number. There were people who lost millions. And
it's like a factory. It's like organized crime is essentially what it is. It's just it's a group. And sometimes they're small groups and sometimes they're large groups sitting in a room making phone calls to thousands of men and women, just hoping they get the one that they can hook.
And I think what you just said is one of the really interesting things about these is all the time when we hear stories about romance scams, when we hear about them, a woman is the victim. But mm-hmm. on the show, one of the things that they talked about is that actually men are mm-hmm. victimized more yes. often by the scammers. And when you think about it, the reasons for that make a whole lot of sense. For one, men are probably less likely to report it, and men likely have access to more money. So for
that's often true, yeah.
So for those two reasons, men are actually attacked more often by these romance scammers, which that's why it's great for these types of stories to get out, just to, because there are people who feel the shame, who feel as though, I must be the only one who's been victimized by this. And no, you're not. There are thousands and thousands of people who've been victimized by it.
It's sad. And it's like, when you start looking at the scams as a whole, it's the same through line. These cons are not new. There's a few cons, and they're just slightly different. They just sprinkle little details that are different in each one. And, you know, there's, especially with the romance scams, there's just certain tells to all of them. And you won't see one, but like, you'll see a few red flags. And I'm like, if there is one red flag, just stop. Just assume if it's too good to be true, it is. And sometimes you win the lottery and sometimes it's real, but sometimes it's not. And I just, instead of shaming it, instead of hiding it, instead of saying this, like, you know, feeling that less than perfect moment, I was like, oh, I'm a smart, intelligent man or woman or person that was taken advantage of. It happens so frequently. It's not just senior citizens that it happens to. People are like, oh, it's just, you know, grandma, grandpa getting scammed out of their retirement money. No, this is working men and women. This is people seeking love. This is people looking for connection. We're lonely. We've been in a pandemic. You think that like scamming stopped during the pandemic? It went up. This is like a $3 billion industry. It's crazy. And it's, we don't even know how much is lost. That's just an estimate. So it's really bad. And it's usually connected to longer grifts. Like, this is not just a short con. Like, if they're really going after you for a large amount of money, it's a long con. They can go on 2-3 years or more.
And is that probably something that makes these types of scams even worse, is that somebody is basically doubly victimized. Not only do they lose a whole lot of money, but they were also emotionally invested and thought that they found their person. So once it gets revealed, they feel super foolish that their emotions were involved and they lost all that money.
Mm-hmm. It's traumatizing. And we don't talk about the mental health effects and that PTSD can come out of it. Not always, but it's very common to have some type of trauma, emotional and mental and physical, because you've lost money, you've lost reputation, you've lost your sense of self. Like, can I trust people again? And as much as, you know, some people like me were paranoid and don't trust anybody, but you know, it shouldn't have to be that way. It shouldn't have to be that way for everybody. You should be able to trust people. You should be able to use your instincts and know if a person's going to screw you over, but you just don't. And unfortunately, when it happens, like, again, the shame and guilt of it, or feeling like I was taken advantage of, there's no way I could have seen it coming. And if I did, you know, 20/20 hindsight's great, but when you're in the middle of it, you sometimes don't see what's right in front of you.
One of the things that I'd like to ask all of my guests is, people listen to this podcast and they want to get into the field. How would somebody who is interested in doing what you do get started to get to where you are?
Be a slightly crazy. Really like learning about people, because human psychology is a huge part of what we do. The scammers use it, the people who harass and abuse you use it. They use a different form of manipulation techniques than I use. Like, manipulation is simply somebody convincing you of something that you already wanted to do, but giving you a rational reason to do it, is kind of how I think about it. It's like the art of persuasion. In a scam, they're persuading you to give them money. They're persuading you that they're in love with you. In my case, it's about understanding your motivations so that I can help you. It's about understanding how we work a little bit as humans, and having a deep empathy, because if you don't have that, you can't do this work, because it will consume you. It is hard and it is emotional what I do, but it's worth it. Again, there's different ends of the spectrum. OSINT itself is very, very broad. Investigations is very, very broad. You may want to work on forensic side of it, like digital forensics. You may want to work on just the OSINT piece. You may want to do analysis. There's a lot of different factors and what you could do. And it's like information security, it's a very broad field. I mean, I've worked in a lot of different types of investigations. I just chose this niche because I'm good at it. But again, you can get certifications for just about anything if you're really good at like numbers. numbers and you like tracking money, certified fraud accountant might be the right thing for you, or a certified fraud examiner. But again, you can do a lot of different things. It just depends on what you want to do, how you want to pursue it. I don't think there's one right way to get into the industry. I just kind of fell into it. And I think that's the story of how everyone ends up in tech or ends up in their specific field. It's like, you start out with a degree in this and you end up here. I mean, I started out with a degree in French and I work in OSINT. So now, mind you, the languages do help me, but like, you can come from any background and learn these skills. I have. So I'm not super technical, but I rely on people who are more deeply knowledgeable on things that I don't know. If I don't understand something, I ask, or I go look it up, or I get a book, or I take a class, because learning is how tech works. It's how OSINT works. If we stop learning, we don't understand how to do the work that we're doing.
So Shannon, you also offer master courses and consultations on your website at lockdownyourlife.com. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining us today on the Layer 8 podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Layer 8 podcast. Please join us in Providence, Rhode Island on Saturday, October 8th for the 5th annual Layer 8 conference. The Layer 8 Conference is a 501c3 nonprofit organization as designated by the United States Internal